history of the 60s.
Juan, you have 30 seconds to wrap up, and then we're going to do this interview in Spanish after the show.
Well, he was just a unique figure in New York City history, and the Latino and the Puerto Rican community, we're all going to miss him, and our condolences to his wife, Debbie, his children, and to his mother, Sally, who was always a big supporter and friend of the young lords.
Well, Juan and Johanna, our condolences and to the whole community about the death of Pablo Guzman, Pablo Yoruba Guzman. Johanna Fernandez, Associate Professor of History at the City University of New York's Baruch College, also author of the award-winning book, The Young Lords, A Radical History. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, traffic deaths are on a rising trajectory in Oregon. The Portland Bureau of Transportation loses $300,000 on an app they won't receive. And new research suggests that coal plant air pollution is more deadly than previously thought. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 28, 2023. KBOO is in our end-of-the-year campaign, so now is a great time to support KBOO. Become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Traveling in Oregon becomes more dangerous every year. The Oregon Health Authority, or OHA, just released its Oregon Transportation Safety Dashboard, and it shows the number of traffic deaths and injuries climbed significantly from 2010 to 2022. The Oregon Department of Transportation already compiles a yearly report of traffic deaths on state highways, but the OHA plays a role as well. The OHA gets a grant from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to work on a variety of injury prevention issues, which includes traffic safety. Dagan Wright is an epidemiologist in the state's Injury and Violence Prevention Program. Wright said compiling a dashboard seemed like a natural extension of their work on injury prevention. The OHA assessed walking, cycling, boating, and driving recreational vehicles, as well as cars. Regardless of how people got around, the past few years have been more dangerous than ever. Despite the pandemic shutdowns, the number of Oregonians who died from transportation-related injuries rose from 530 to 597 in 2021, and then to 606 in 2022. In all, the number of Oregon traffic deaths per year rose 73% from 2010 to 2022. Traffic injury-related hospital and emergency room visits have remained relatively flat. Death rates might be rising. Trucks and SUVs are more dangerous to cyclists, pedestrians, and motorcycle riders because they're built higher up from the ground and because people are driving faster. In 2015, the legislature passed a bill that increased speed limits for many state highways. Traffic deaths on those roads rose in the years that followed. Urban areas like Portland Metro, Salem, and Eugene had more traffic deaths than their rural counterparts, reflecting larger populations. But the death rates were actually higher in some rural areas. Gilliam County in the east had the highest average four-year death rate, despite representing one of Oregon's least populated areas. The main goal of the data dashboard is to make it useful to the public. It could also lead to policy changes. The state expects the dashboard to be a living document, with updates coming on a regular basis. The Portland Bureau of Transportation paid nearly $300,000 for an app it will never receive. That's according to new reporting from Willamette Week. They found the Transportation Department paid a Canadian software developer to build an app for a program to subsidize and offer discounts for bus passes, electronic scooter rentals, and other alternative transportation methods. Bureau officials told volunteers in a letter Monday that they had canceled the contract and they wouldn't be getting their money back. The Bureau had planned to create an app to make their transportation wallet program easier to use. The funds it used came from the Northwest and Central East Side parking districts, mainly from people buying parking passes in those areas. Earlier this year, things started to go awry. PBOT said they didn't realize how expensive it would be to operate the app on an ongoing basis. Losing nearly $300,000 is yet another hit to the financially struggling department. PBOT is facing a $32 million budget deficit that has yet to be resolved. The department is facing cuts to its most basic services. The Environmental Protection Agency plans to adopt ambitious new greenhouse gas emissions rules for cargo and diesel trucks, which would help spur the transition to electric trucks. But advocates say the nation needs a plan for charging infrastructure to accommodate these new medium-duty and heavy-duty vehicles. Nadia Romligan reports.
Clean energy advocates say now is the time for the government to ensure the nation has the medium and heavy-duty truck infrastructure needed to keep electric-powered trucks charged and driving across the country. Trucks transported more than 11 billion tons of freight last year, spewing air pollutants and greenhouse gases along the way. John Bozell with CalSTART, a clean energy transportation nonprofit group, explains the EPA is considering rules to require commercial vehicle manufacturers to drastically curb emissions in the coming years. But he says the agency should also figure out how to roll out national infrastructure to keep pace with the adoption of EV trucks.
In the future, the Biden administration has a tremendous opportunity to really make progress in terms of supporting communities that have disproportionately been impacted by diesel truck and pollution.
The roadmap developed by CalSTART calls for building truck charging stations in areas where industry is already concentrated, and then integrating hubs and corridors into an ever-expanding network, mostly along established supply chain routes. Critics say trucking companies and drivers have concerns about EV costs, mileage range, battery weight and safety, charging time, and availability. This year, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced the future locations of 27 new electric vehicle charging stations that will be installed along Ohio interstates. Bozell adds the growth of e-commerce has led to skyrocketing emissions as more people and businesses order products online that are delivered by truck.
See a society where we have trucks rolling around with zero emission and zero noise. Truck drivers being much happier driving an electric truck.
He says addressing the impact of heavy-duty vehicle pollution could lower public health risks for drivers, communities, and the planet. According to the market research firm PwC, the nation's charging market will need to grow nearly tenfold to meet demand, driven by an estimated 27 million EVs on the road by 2030. This is Nadia Romligan for Ohio News Connection.
New research issued this week shows that emissions from coal-fired power plants resulted in nearly a 500,000 premature deaths in the United States over the past two decades. That's more than previous estimates, prompting urgent calls to accelerate the use of clean energy sources and establish stricter regulations. Mike Moen has the details in Wisconsin.
Researchers are out with new findings they say show that death rates linked to air pollution from coal plants are underestimated. A Wisconsin environmental group hopes the study compels quicker action to cut harmful emissions. The study, led by experts at a handful of U.S. universities, found that over the past two decades, there were 460,000 premature deaths nationally associated with fine particulate matter sent into the air from coal-fired power plants. That's more than what health and scientific communities had previously thought. Kieran Gallagher with the group Clean Wisconsin says while coal facilities are being phased out, utilities and policymakers should speed up the energy transition.
A lot of wind and solar is being added to the electricity grid every day, which is really exciting to see in Wisconsin, across the Midwest, and it just needs to ramp up faster.
Utilities around the U.S. have announced emissions goals, but some companies contend certain fossil fuels can't be completely put to rest right away because of electricity demands while cleaner sources are added. But Gallagher says the regulatory scene in states like Wisconsin makes it easier for utilities to move the goalposts. She's hopeful stricter standards being weighed by the federal EPA will prompt stronger commitments. Gallagher has analyzed the proposed regulations and says that in Wisconsin, they could result in nearly $50 million in broader health benefits by reducing the impact of respiratory illnesses and cardiovascular disease.
$50 million is a massive benefit for Wisconsinites to see in health benefits from the closed coal plants in our state.
She says the new study might mean that the health benefits could even be higher. Federal data show that coal contributed to 36% of Wisconsin's electricity generation in 2022, down from more than half as recently as 2018. Meanwhile, study authors show that the rate of deaths from coal pollution began to slow as more plants were being shut down. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
Portland City Council will consider a $2.6 million contract with Axon for body cameras for Portland police at Wednesday's council session. The City Council will meet virtually as renovations have started on City Hall to accommodate the new 12-member City Council in 2025. Portland police completed a pilot program for body cameras in October. Using them is part of a settlement with the Department of Justice that has been in effect for nearly a decade. Negotiations over using body cameras took several years. If commissioners vote for the proposal, the city will go ahead with purchasing the body cameras and putting more funding towards training the whole bureau on how to use them. House Republicans differ on January 6th footage. Speaker Johnson says any Ukraine funding must include changes to border policy. And former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said former President Trump is fueling anti-Semitism and hate. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You know, when you see the footage yourself, it's going to give you an understanding of what was there and what occurred that day, because we're currently only depending upon really partisan descriptions of what happens. Now the American people can see.
House Intelligence Chair Mike Turner of Ohio calls the release of 40,000 hours of video from the January 6th Capitol attack an important step for the truth. Speaker Mike Johnson ordered the video be gradually posted on a House website, despite objections from Capitol Police that it could pose a security risk. Turner, a Republican, says lawmakers from both parties have cherry-picked the footage. His comment came when asked about Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia calling the attack an inside job by the Capitol Police themselves. Colorado Congressman Ken Buck says if his fellow Republicans want to solve America's problems, they have to face some unpleasant truths.
Everyone who makes the argument that January 6th was, an unguided tour of the Capitol is lying to America.
Back from Thanksgiving, lawmakers are debating President Joe Biden's $100 billion Israel and Ukraine aid package. Speaker Johnson says he's confident Congress can get to a deal on it, but funds for Ukraine must come with changes to border policy.
I think most of our Senate colleagues recognize that those two things need to move together because we owe that to the American people. That's what they're demanding that we do.
Johnson's plan to pay for just aid to Israel by cutting the IRS died in the Senate. Hardline Republicans still want budget cuts to offset the Ukraine funds, and Vermont progressive Bernie Sanders says aid for Israel should demand steps to stop the fighting. Qatar says the 2 days added to the hostage release ceasefire negotiated with Israel and Hamas could be extended again. The Biden administration says it'll press for the ceasefire to continue until all the hostages are home. And Biden repeated his call for a two-state solution as a full end to the conflict. 7 weeks before the Iowa caucuses, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says the Republican candidates need to face how bad former President Donald Trump is for the country and the party. He charges Trump with whipping up hate and anti-Semitism.
Intolerance towards anyone encourages intolerance towards everyone. And that's exactly what's going on here.
Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers are urging a New York appeals court to extend a pause in the gag order against him in his civil trial. They say the hundreds of threats made to the presiding judge and his law clerk don't justify limiting Trump's First Amendment. The New Mexico Supreme Court has unanimously upheld the state's congressional map for next year's election. State Republicans had sued, arguing the map was a Democratic gerrymander. And a three-week strike in Portland, Oregon has ended following a tentative agreement between the teachers' union and the school district. Portland Association of Teachers President Angela Bonilla says it includes wins on class size, teachers' pay, and mental health support for students.
We all came together, we stuck together, and that's what made this possible.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. We are in our end-of-the-year campaign, and you can support KBOO by becoming a member at any time during this broadcast by going to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. They're tracking Portland City Council's decision to gut voter-approved police reform. At 6 o'clock, it's the Anonymous Eskimo Project. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 33 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 42 degrees. Today in history, in 1960, Mauritania becomes independent of France. It's the 11th largest country in Africa, with 90% of its territory situated in the Sahara Desert. The quote of the day is from American fashion designer Virgil Abloh, who died this day in 2021. He said, quote, "Fashion and music are two great artistic forms that can be molded by the youth culture. Our taste and our passion for evolving things in our limited time on Earth allows us to look at things with fresh eyes." Oregon is no stranger to expensive elections, and this year, Kentucky's governor's race broke records. Candidates raised more than $44.6 million in 2023, and independent political groups spent additional millions more boosting their preferred candidate. When adjusted for inflation, the governor's race this year was the third most expensive on record. Nadia Ramlagan has the story.
When adjusted for inflation, Kentucky's gubernatorial race this year ranks among the most expensive in state history. Candidates in the primary and general election raised more than $44.6 million, according to an Open Secrets analysis of campaign finance reports. Democratic Governor Andy Beshear's top funder was the Kentucky Democratic Party. Both the KNP and Beshear are now under civil investigation by state campaign finance regulators for allegedly accepting political contributions over the legal limit. From London, Kentucky, Mayor Randall Weddle. Open Secrets Money and Politics reporter Jimmy Cloutier says outsiders also shelled out major cash to both the winner, Beshear, and his rival, Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron.
This election also brought in a lot of money from independent political groups that weren't connected to the campaign. So those groups spent an additional $45.3 million, mostly on negative ads.
In June, after reporting by the Kentucky Lantern, Beshear announced that his campaign and the Kentucky Democratic Party inadvertently took $202,000 in excess contributions from Weddle, but noted the money was refunded. The investigation is ongoing, according to the Kentucky Registry of Election Finance. Cloutier says the cost of federal and more recently state elections have increased dramatically over the last several years, favoring those with an established media presence and making it more challenging for new faces to get a foot in the door.
For a political newcomer who might not have that name recognition, these fundraising totals are hard to surmount. And so election costs can be prohibitive.
Since this will be Beshear's second consecutive term as governor, he must wait at least one election cycle before running for governor again. Kentucky is one of 26 states that allow governors to serve an unlimited number of four-year terms. This story was produced with original reporting from Jimmy Cloutier for Open Secrets. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
Today is Giving Tuesday, a tradition where people make charitable donations on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. Experts in detecting fraud have some tips on how to make sure your contributions don't fall into the wrong hands. Suzanne Potter has more.
Today is Giving Tuesday, a day when millions of Americans are expected to make charitable donations, but it can also be a field day for scammers. Experts have tips on how to make sure your contribution ends up in the right hands. California Attorney General Rob Bonta says charities are required to file financial reports with the State Department of Justice, so you can go online and check their registration status.
You can use our registry search tool at oag.ca.gov under charities to ensure a charity is in good standing and is up to date with its financial reporting requirements.
Consumers are urged to read those financial reports to find out what percentage of the charity's revenue is spent on the mission versus on staff and overhead. Experts also warn people not to fall for pressure tactics used on telemarketing calls. Bonta urges people to check the name, email, and web address carefully to be certain that you don't fall prey to a scammer posing as a real charity.
Take, for example, the American Red Cross of California. Sounds good, but that's not the American Red Cross that we know and love. It sounds like the Red Cross, but that was actually the name of a now defunct organization that our office ordered to cease and desist back in 2019 for misleading donors.
Another tip, be careful if you are asked to make a donation via text, QR code, or portable credit card reader. Verify that the person asking truly represents a legitimate charity. Get a receipt and check your credit card statement right away to make sure you were charged the correct amount. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Canadian coal mines are contributing nearly all of the selenium pollution in one Montana lake. That's according to a new study that demonstrates how high selenium is damaging to fish and wildlife. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new study finds that Canadian coal mines contribute nearly all of the selenium found in a Montana lake. Aaron Bolton with Montana Public Radio has more.
For decades, coal mines along British Columbia's Elk River have sent large amounts of selenium into Lake Coconusa in northwest Montana. Selenium is naturally occurring, but at high levels can harm fish reproduction. Researchers wanted to know how much natural selenium came from the lake's largest tributary, the Kootenai River. Study author and U.S. Geological Survey hydrologist Merrill Storb.
Over the last decade, the Elk River is contributing 95% of the selenium into Coconusa from those two sources.
That's striking because the Elk River accounts for a quarter of all waters flowing into Lake Coconusa, but is contributing nearly all of the selenium. Montana and British Columbia tribes are pushing U.S. and Canadian officials to shut the mines down. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The House Natural Resources Committee will host a roundtable titled Strengthening Historic and Cultural Preservation. The roundtable is in commemoration of Native American Heritage Month. The panel will discuss how Congress can better support and improve historic and cultural preservation. Panelists include tribal historic preservation officers and tribal leaders. Members of Congress expected to attend are House Natural Resources Committee Ranking Member Raul Grijalva, Indian and Insular Affairs Subcommittee Ranking Member Teresa Legere Fernandez, and Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee Ranking Member Melanie Stansberry. The roundtable will take place in person in Washington, D.C. Wednesday and will also be live streamed. Two small business owners rooted in Western Alaska have spent countless hours preparing for a busy holiday season as people gear up for gift giving. KNOM's Ava White has more.
For artists with small businesses, the holiday season kicks off well before the temperature starts to change. Shirley Hooch of Ammonic is a Yupik jeweler who specializes in handmade earrings made of caribou antler and walrus ivory. She says this inspired her to begin making jewelry. The first earring she ever created, she says, remained one of her most popular sellers, and they resemble traditional Yupik masks. She says she never makes more than 5 pairs of the same earrings, so each pair is truly unique.
By supporting artists and jewelers and carvers, you only get one-of-a-kind treasures, you know.
Nikki Corbett of Bethel is the owner of a popular cuspuck company called So Yupik. Corbett says that when you support Alaska Native artists through your purchases, you have the chance to engage and connect with their culture.
I don't want people to be wearing the same one, but I really try to just make each one individualized with its trimming and the, you know, accent hoods or cowls or...
She says she makes sure to set good intentions, because if she doesn't, she risks passing negative energy through the piece that she's sewing, and that can transfer to the customer. I'm Ava White.
The state of Oregon recently announced its first tribal affairs director. Shanna McConville Radford will serve in that position. Radford recently was the deputy executive director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. She has more than 15 years of experience with tribal relations, policy, and intergovernmental affairs. Radford will help with communications and collaborations with the 9 tribes in the state. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war was extended by 2 days yesterday. One commentator says Israel's attacks on the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City have been a humanitarian disaster and a moral failing. The claim that the hospital has hidden a command center of Hamas remains unproven, but even if demonstrated, it would not justify the targeting of a major hospital, he says. Israel should use the ceasefire to restore hospital services and call for help from international medical NGOs. We now go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Today's episode, in collaboration with my colleague Larry Kirsch, is a critical examination of Israel's Al-Shifa operation. Israel's attack on the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City has become both the reality and the symbol of all that's wrong with its war on Hamas. The attack raises two issues: the steep human cost of laying siege to Gaza's last functioning hospital, and the lack of evidence so far that the hospital grounds are cover for Hamas military operations. As a result, the Israeli government's hope to convey the righteousness of its response to the October 7 atrocities is being obscured by a military assault that is disproportionate, not to mention possibly based on erroneous claims. We offer recommendations for dealing with the issues in ways that are humane and in the best interest of all sides to the conflict. Israeli military operations at Al-Shifa have made the hospital unsafe for patients and staff and have precipitated an indescribable humanitarian crisis in Gaza City and along the entire Gaza Strip. The shutdown of basic hospital infrastructure and ordinary medical resources, electricity, fuel, drugs, and supplies, have left newborns without functioning incubators, wounded surgical patients without anesthetics, and older residents without the care and security every compassionate individual would hope for. Some fuel deliveries are resuming, but are not nearly enough, according to UN officials. There is concern that the sewage system might collapse, bringing on the spread of disease. Israel's claim that Al-Shifa is a legitimate military target when so many civilian lives are at stake and Gaza's hospital system is in shatters cannot be justified. Nor can the facts support Israel's claim that Hamas has used the tunnel system beneath the hospital as a command center. To the contrary, the Israeli operations have severely degraded the country's precious stock of moral authority by equating its military defense with the right to take offensive action against defenseless, hospitalized non-combatants. No matter how the facts of the Al-Shifa tunnel system ultimately shake out, if they do, the moral damage to Israel will have already taken its toll. To be clear, even if Al-Sharif turns out to have been a Hamas military post, that cannot undermine, much less condone, the targeting of a major hospital. As US, UN, and many other sources agree, Gaza faces a humanitarian catastrophe, to which Secretary of State Antony Blinken has added that it is a catastrophe for Israel and not just for Gaza's people. The hospital assault can only increase the casualty count, already over 12,000 dead, and the flight of refugees. Add to that suffering must be added the alienation of a good part of the international community, the widening gap between Israel and the US over war policy, prolongation of prospects for a ceasefire, and Israel's violation of the laws of war. On that last point, Mathilde Philippe-Gay, an expert in international humanitarian law at Lyon University in France, recently told The Guardian that international humanitarian law, as set forth in the Geneva Conventions, provides that, quote, it is forbidden to turn recognized civilian hospitals into a conflict zone. It is also forbidden to use civilian populations, the sick or the injured, as human shields. It is a war crime, as is fitting from inside a hospital, unquote. While clearly demonstrated, ongoing military use of the tunnels by Hamas against Israeli forces might provide justification for a limited Israeli operation, but Israel has neither made such a claim nor provided the required demonstration. The best recourse available to Israel at this juncture would be to announce and implement an immediate and complete cessation of military operations against Al-Shifa and all medical facilities in Gaza, restore full electric service, the supply of fuel and delivery of drugs and other vital supplies, including water, blood, and communications. The limited ceasefire that took effect last Friday would be the moment to make that announcement. At the same time, Israel should request the assistance of the outstanding medical humanitarian NGOs on the ground, including Doctors Without Borders, Mercy Corps, and Norway's Emergency Medical Team. These organizations can make an assessment of needs and medical capacity, provide direct medical assistance at Al-Shifa and other facilities, and coordinate the immediate resupply of medical equipment and supplies from the Rafah border. A vital component of the Israeli commitment would be to provide security for the NGO staff living and working in the hospitals and medical facilities in Gaza. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 28, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Josh Salem, Sam Bowman, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. My name is Sam, and this is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly segment dedicated to police accountability in Portland. On November 15th, the city attorney appeared before city council seeking approval